It's not room service today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Phoenix, a local newspaper reports that local Motel 6s have been giving information on their guests to immigration officials. This reporter spoke with one guest who checked in, and then
around 11 p.m. that night, he's watching TV. There's a knock on the door, and it's two ICE agents.
Plus, some Muslims in Houston work to help clean up after Harvey.
I consider what we're doing today a kind of a peaceful protest. We don't go and raise slogans and join these marches and create disorder. What we do is we help out neighborhoods that need us. That word travels.
Those stories, plus what it means to be an American making your way through a post-American world. Stick around. It's The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. We want to begin with storms and what happens in their aftermath, both inside and outside the U.S. President Trump is in Florida to survey the damage done by Hurricane Irma. The cleanup will no doubt be a long and expensive process, a process that's already started in Texas after Harvey drowned large parts of the state. The World's Monica Campbell was recently in Houston to report for our partners at the BBC, and she's with me now to share one story of communities coming together through the recovery process. Monica, tell us whom you met.
Well, after the storm, I'd heard about different groups and communities coming together, and I saw that there was one group of young Muslim Americans, a Muslim American Youth Association, and they were out volunteering in some of the hardest hit areas of Houston, and I met one of the younger volunteers. And his name was Rahman Nasser. And I was invited to his home. Of course, I went and we had tea and I met his parents. And his dad told me why they moved to the U.S. from Pakistan.
Our community is very heavily persecuted in Pakistan. And it is called the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. We are the Muslims who believe in Messiah.
And they burn our houses and businesses in 1974. After that, my eldest brother, he was here. When he heard about us, he wants all of us over here.
So your brother was here first, and yes. Then the rest of the family yes. came along, and it was for safety?
Yes. That's the only reason. Otherwise, we love our country.
Actually, my wife's house was about to be burned down in 1974 when this persecution actually was at the height. Then when I was living in Abbottabad, my brothers were actually attacked and beaten, and so was I, physically beaten. And that's like one incident.
It's such a difficult time at times to be a Muslim and American in the United States.
After 9/11 and all these things, I saw those things again in my life. Whenever my kids go outside, I'm afraid.
For their son, Rahman, and long-term family friend, Bilal, the storm is a chance to change that narrative, an opportunity both to help their neighbors and to improve the image of Muslims within the community. They've been volunteering with their youth group since before the storm hit, but in the wake of Harvey, it's a chance to be visible, trying to demonstrate to people a different side to Muslims than the one they're familiar with from the news. As they set out for a day, helping families clear out their homes in a low-income neighborhood in northeast Houston, they put on their uniform, shirts reading, quote, "Ask me anything, I'm a Muslim."
My name is Bilal Rana, and I serve as the president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Youth Association.
It is hot.
I know. And it's really humid this week because of the floods. We just passed an apartment complex. And we
everything is on the street.
Yeah.
It's like the houses just
this is a typical scene.
Wow.
So we see everything. Chest of drawers is out, desks, lamps, sofas, all the heavy stuff, the next one. Refrigerators, televisions.
It's as if houses were completely turned inside out. How do you decide where to stop, who to help? How are you guys going about this?
Well, we're a bunch of young men, so we focus on heavy lifting first. And we know that these families aren't going to be able to do that by themselves. So we ask them to identify, hey, what are the heavy things that you think you're going to have trouble?
Okay.
Mexican-American family right here. We've been helping them all day. We can go and check in inside, see
sure,
how they're doing.
Go.
Hi. You're a little out of breath.
I am. I've been cleaning up, helping the guys that are helping me.
These guys showed up a few days ago, right?
Showed up, and they've been all down, up and down my street helping my neighbors. And this morning I asked them if they could help us because they were across the street, and they've been here all day in this heat and this smell. My name is Sonia Saldana, and this is my son Isaac Saldana, and he's 13 years. And he's always with me. He's always helping us out, which is a very good thing at this time. This is our living room.
How high was the water here in your living room?
Chest high to me, and I'm 5'2". I didn't think the storm was going to be this bad. I felt it was...
My mom wanted to live here.
I wanted to stay here?
Stay here, but I said, Mom, just leave, because you're going to start raining more, and you're going to all flood. I said, Mom, you just go with the dogs.
Yeah, he kept telling me to go, and I was like, no, it's not going to be that bad. But it was.
He was watching out for you.
Yes, he was. He was.
I always care for my family.
Yes, you do. You do. We're safe. We're together. So it's just rebuilding and coming back home.
And you got help.
Yes, and I got help. Lots of it.
Had you had much interaction with Muslim Americans?
Never. This is the first time. Besides the news, you know, or something like a lot
of negative news.
Yes, negative news, yes. And this is so positive.
My name is Rahman Nasser. I'm part of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Youth Association, and I live in Houston, Texas. I've lived here my whole life. When this flood came about, when this storm came about, I was stuck at home for 2-3 days, and I saw the devastation it brought, and I felt terrible being stuck at home, not being able to do anything.
So. Do you feel like this is a chance to bring communities together?
I absolutely do. I mean, all these social walls have been lifted. I can go up to anyone in the city right now. Everyone's a family. Anyone can talk to anyone.
The voice of Rahman Nasser there saying, anyone's a family. Anyone can talk to anyone. Monica Campbell, after a disaster, it is not uncommon for this feeling of camaraderie to emerge, but then things go back to normal after the recovery. Do you think that this connection is going to last?
Yeah, I see your point. I feel like these connections are deep. Rahman in particular, who I talked to quite a bit, he had so many moving moments in this neighborhood. I mean, one of them was that they were there with the group and they were praying actually in the street, and they were continuing, you know, their Muslim practices in this neighborhood, you know, which was something I think a lot of people in that neighborhood had never really seen. But they also went to the local church just down the street to connect with the church there. And there was a group prayer, and they met the pastors there, and they felt like, you know, these are places we want to come back to. And what's really interesting is that Rahman in particular, he only lives 15 minutes away from this neighborhood that was so hard hit and where they were volunteering and cleaning up. Just 15 minutes away. But it felt like a world away. Now they're connected, and they've raised money, and they told me many times, you know, we're going to come back to this community. We're neighbors now. We want to see how the cleanup goes. We want to help them. They see how long the recovery is going to be. And I really am interested to see how these neighborhoods stay connected, and I look forward to going back and keeping up with this story and these groups.
Monica Campbell with our Global Nation Desk. Thanks for telling us this story.
Thanks so much, Marco.
If you haven't already, take a listen to the rest of Monica's remarkable documentary for the BBC. We have a link at PRI.org. Meanwhile, I suppose it's small comfort, but at least people slogging through the aftermath of Harvey and Irma can take heart in the fact that they're not alone. Millions of people around the world have been hit by heavy flooding this summer, from the U.S. and the West Indies to South Asia and China. In many of these places, there's been little official warning that high water is coming and little help once it's arrived. But extreme weather events are on the rise around the world, and some governments are trying to get ready for what might be coming. Reporter Tipa Fernandez recently went to Peru, where the weather game is changing and the government is trying to stay ahead of it.
The weather in northern Peru has been extremely unusual for a couple years now. But what happened on March 27 of this year shocked everyone.
Hello, señorita Diana, por favor.
Please, we urgently need help.
This is an SOS voicemail left by Araceli Chero Mendoza, who lives in the town of Piura. That morning, she woke up to a nightmare. Their major river had breached. Water was coming in. people were panicking.
We are 500 families here. Children who haven't eaten.
Mendoza's low-income neighborhood was right by the river and would be hit hard. The church is about to disappear underwater, Mendoza cries. She desperately begs for help. One of those 500 families was Ana Chera Ramos and her three children. As the water rose, she and others didn't wait for help to arrive. They grabbed what little they could and fled. We ran up into the nearby mountains, she tells me. Everything was underwater, so we had to stay in the mountains, she says. After a couple of days, help finally arrived. They received a tent and food packages. But the fact that families lived in the mountains with nothing for more than a day is not something Eduardo Pineda, Piura's regional director for economic development, is proud of.
Pero definitivamente no estábamos
Without
preparados.
A doubt, we were unprepared, he admits.
Y fue un tema de casi tres meses de arduo trabajo.
Pineda tells me that they worked night and day once the flooding began. But the fact remains, officials didn't see it coming. So his government began looking at why this happened, because knowing why might help them be more prepared in the future. And Pineda says they kept coming back to one thing.
Climate change is a reality.
Last year, Piura saw a crippling drought, one of its most severe ever. His government declared a state of emergency. Then, just like that, it started raining. But not the usual rains. There were torrential downpours every day for months. The weather snapped from one extreme to the other.
We're convinced that all these changes in our weather, the drought, the torrential rains, these are the effects of global warming.
Why? Well, consider just the rain pattern, he tells me.
Generally, in Piura, in a normal year, we get about 100 millimeters of rain. This year, we had over 300 millimeters of rain in just one day. We had about 2,400 millimeters of rain in 3 months.
That's 24 times what they usually get for a whole year. Climate change probably didn't cause all that rain or the drought that preceded it. This part of South America normally goes through wet and dry periods driven by the El Niño weather cycle. But it probably made them both worse than they would have been otherwise. Scientists say rising global temperatures are bringing more extreme weather to just about every corner of the globe. That's why the head of Piura's National Security and Defense Agency, Eduardo Gonzalez, now has his team monitoring the weather as the most serious threat to the region. One tool they use is a daily ocean temperature report. If the water is heating up, Colonel Gonzalez says, that means storms are coming.
Normally, the ocean is between 19 and 21 degrees. Right now, it's actually 17 degrees, so the water is cold. But at the beginning of the year, we noticed it getting progressively hotter. And then in January, the rain started.
People need to be prepared, he says. And that means more than carrying an umbrella with them.
We have a lot of houses that are quite flimsy. So we have to alert people if we think rains are coming so they can protect themselves, protect their children.
But it's not just about the weather. Another big problem the local government identified, according to Ronald Ruiz Chapiaquen, Piura's regional general for the environment, was that the river that breached had been robbed of its natural protections over the years.
A lot of the damage occurred because of the deforestation around the river. Also, the river's natural outlets into the ocean have been closed off. There was just too much water for the river to hold.
Chapiaquen says the land around the river must be reforested to help it hold more water. There are also plans to try and balance out some of the extremes by building a reservoir system to capture rainwater from the downpours to hold for times of prolonged drought.
We have to think differently now. How do we capture the torrential rains? How do we regulate big flows of water? And if we can do that, then maybe we can better defend our cities, our people.
And they're not stopping there, he says. Next month, Piura will host a conference on how climate change is affecting coastal and agricultural regions, seeking advice from scientists and industry experts on how it can be better prepared. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Piura, Peru.
After the break, South Korea goes public with its new plan for dealing with Kim Jong-un in the North, an assassination. You're with The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. More scary talk today from North Korea. An official statement on state TV there threatened to sink Japan and reduce the U.S. to ashes. Not surprising, there's been a lot of fiery rhetoric coming out of North Korea and the U.S. this summer. The question everyone wants answered, where is it all headed? Here's The World's Matthew Bell.
At times, Donald Trump sounds like someone who is ready to do the unthinkable in response to North Korea.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
That was Trump speaking last month, before the North Koreans conducted their sixth nuclear test. It was their biggest yet by far, and the threats from Pyongyang keep coming. This week, a Washington-based reporter, Laura Rosen, who writes for the Al-Monitor website, said that experts at think tanks linked with the Trump administration are working on plans for a post-war North Korea. It's a little reminiscent of the summer of 2002, when George W. Bush's administration began its steady march toward war in Iraq. So is the Trump administration actually gaming out what regime change might look like in North Korea?
Well, yes and no, and let me explain why.
Eli Ratner is an Asia expert at the Council on Foreign Relations.
I don't think we are on the precipice of a U.S. invasion of North Korea at this point. I don't think there's anyone among President Trump's senior national security team who's clamoring for an invasion, and that's really a significant difference between the situation now and the summer of 2002, as you described.
At the same time, Ratner says there are lots of unknowns in North Korea. Economic pressure or political upheaval could, in fact, lead to unrest or even the collapse of Kim Jong-un's government.
Instability in North Korea would present huge challenges across the board, and not just on security issues, but also economic, humanitarian, political, diplomatic. So I actually think the U.S. government should be planning for potential instability scenarios as it pursues a maximum pressure strategy.
And maximum pressure is the best way to deal with North Korea, according to Anthony Ruggiero. He's an expert on economic sanctions at the Conservative Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Ruggiero says he's not aware of any call by the Trump administration to step up planning for regime change, but he says the administration is already imposing tough new sanctions.
If you're looking at an escalation curve or escalation ladder, however you want to describe it, we're certainly at the beginning end of that, but it's clear that there's a pattern there.
Ruggiero points to the Obama administration's experience with Iran. It was the pain brought on by economic sanctions, he says, that forced the Iranians to the negotiation table. There's another option for North Korea that many experts once considered unthinkable, and that's learning to live with North Korea's nuclear weapons. It's controversial, but some say it's time for the U.S. to focus on containing the North Korean nuclear threat. It's something being discussed with new seriousness in Washington, but Asia expert Peter Brooks at the Heritage Foundation says it's a bad idea.
I don't buy into that. I think we have concerns about proliferation. I'm worried about proliferation beyond North Korea, especially to Iran, where we should always be open to diplomacy. I think we should understand where we're at, including North Korea's willingness to do this. But things change. I think it was Niels Bohr, a Danish physicist, who said prediction's hard, especially about the future.
President Trump was asked last week if he could envision one day accepting a nuclear North Korea. Trump sort of dodged the question. He dismissed negotiations with the North and said he would prefer not to use military force, but that's something, he said, that could happen. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
You can't make this stuff up, although some people have certainly tried. Like that 2014 comedy, The Interview, remember? Seth Rogen and James Franco are journalists who set up an interview with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and are then recruited by the CIA to assassinate him. North Korea was furious with the plot, threatened action against the U.S. if the movie was released. The actors got death threats, and many theaters decided to not even screen the film. Now, 3 years later, life duplicates art. There's a real life plan to assassinate Kim Jong-un, and it's been publicly announced by South Korea. Isaac Stonefish is a reporter and a fellow at the Asia Society in New York. This story is pretty crazy, Isaac. What prompted South Korea's announcement of a hit squad?
I think they're looking for ways to deter North Korea that don't involve actually placing nuclear weapons in South Korea. And I think the understanding is that to the North Koreans, Kim Jong-un's life is worth thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. So if they can have a credible threat that they're going to take out the leader, then that might work as a very effective deterrence.
I mean, I've heard of nuclear deterrence. This sounds like assassination deterrence. I mean, what kind of unit will this be?
So the details are sparse, and it's actually shocking that we know any details at all because, well, I mean, they're not covert actions when you announce them and they're published right in the New York Times. But it would be a special unit that would be able to sneak into North Korea and try to take down the state. That could mean placing a bomb in Kim Jong-un's car. That could mean other methods of destabilization. But I think it's just a way for South Korea to say to North Korea, hey, we really mean business here.
I mean, just realistically, Isaac, how hard would it be to kill Kim Jong-un? My sense is that he's surrounded by only the most trusted associates. And if he doesn't trust you, you're probably already dead, right?
You know, it's funny. I think that actually his threat comes much more from within. Dictatorships are so inherently unstable, and I think it's much more likely that one of his trusted associates slits his throat than that a South Korean agent can get access to the inner world. It's kind of similar to what happened with South Korea in the 60s and 70s. It was ruled by a dictator, and North Koreans tried to assassinate him in the late 60s. They failed. They got within, I think, 100 meters of South Korea's White House, the Blue House. And there was this massive gun battle and, you know, huge, huge story. But then 10 years later, the South Korean dictator's own trusted aide killed him.
As you know, bluster has been one of the hallmarks so far of the saber rattling between the West and its allies and North Korea. Do you think South Korea could just be blowing total smoke here? Could this just be menacing propaganda?
It certainly could be. And it's funny, we've seen since Trump took office him starting to rival North Korea in the absurd bluster. His comment about fire and fury, like the world has never seen. So maybe South Korea is joining this bluster arms race with a threat to decapitate the North Korean leadership.
If you had to guess, what do you think North Korea is making of this threat?
It's always so difficult to know how the North Korean leadership perceives anything at all. I mean, I think that this to them justifies the way they see the world, the way they see South Korea, this idea that they are really alone, North Korea against the world. This gives ammunition to Pyongyang to be able to say to its people, hey, listen, we are really the victims here. The South Korean puppets with their American overlords are trying to take away our leader, and this is why we have to defend ourselves. This is why we have to prioritize the army. This is why we have to live the way we live, because we're being attacked from the outside.
Journalist Isaac Stonefish, he's also a fellow at the Asia Society. Thanks for being with us, Isaac.
Thanks, Marka.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Nada, zilch, zip, the big goose egg.
Zero is such an important number in our modern age, and I think people take it for granted, but it has a history, and I was really fascinated to know where our zero came from.
A new chapter in the story of zero, a whole lot of nothing, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Imagine an armed conflict in Eastern Europe, say Belarus. Terrorists from another country take over, and Russia sends in troops to restore order. If you're having a hard time imagining this, the Russian military is not. This is the actual premise for Russian war games that are happening now in Belarus. It's called Zapad 2017. And while it's only war games, for a lot of people just a little to the west, in the Baltic states or Poland, it doesn't feel like much of a game. Reporter Charles Maines joins us now from Moscow. So tell us more about this drill itself, Charles.
Well, this has been an annual kind of large-scale military games that the Russians run. They've been doing this. They did it in the Soviet period. They started picking it up again in 1999 with the arrival of Vladimir Putin to power. So what you see today is this, as you note, this kind of collection of Russian and Belarusian troops trying to take on an alliance of these fictitious countries. They're called Vishnoria, Vesbaria, and Lubania. And as you note, they're basically stand-ins for Poland and the Baltic states, which, of course, were once allies or part of the Soviet Union and now are NATO members. And it does make them nervous in the Baltic states and Poland. Russia, however, says this is routine stuff, that they, of course, just conduct these exercises once every few years. They're defensive in nature. And you heard the presidential spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, he's Vladimir Putin's spokesman today, say that the West is whipping up hysteria over this by making so much noise about this. And they essentially see it here as an excuse to justify a NATO military buildup in Eastern Europe.
The other detail that makes those Baltic states and Poland really nervous is that isn't this like the biggest war games Russia's staged in a while?
Well, yes and no. You know, the Russians say that there are only 12,700 troops taking part in this, less than half of them being Russian troops, the majority being Belarusian troops. But there seems to be this kind of numbers game going on here, a discrepancy in what the Russians insist are participating and what the West says are the number of troops taking part in this exercise. This goes back to this document called the Vienna Document, which says that if you use over 13,000 troops in mass exercises, you have to invite foreign observers to take part. So the estimates essentially here are that they may actually run 100,000 troops. And that's something we saw in previous drills that they've done in 2015 and 2016, where those numbers were there in different parts of Russia, I might add, though.
I gather that there will be 80 observers from Western nations for these exercises. What does that tell us?
Well, I think it says a little bit about the difference between how Belarus, I think, is playing this. Belarus tends to kind of position itself these days between the West and Russia as an intermediary. For example, we saw, you know, the American officials and Russian officials meeting in Minsk to talk about how to resolve the conflict in Ukraine. Belarusian officials said that they've got all these observers coming from Western nations, including Poland, the Baltic states, NATO, the OSCE. Whereas the Russians, while they say they're being transparent, they've actually, it's not entirely clear that's the case. There have been reports of giving accreditation, for example, one day to watch the exercises rather than the whole week. So I think there's a sense that the Russians are just playing a bit of cat and mouse on that front.
So what do you think Russia is up to here, and how are they talking about this exercise?
Well, you know, for them, they say it's a defensive measure. This is something that I think you've seen them do on a regular basis, as I said, over the past several years. It's become a way for Russia to show its military preparedness. Certainly, there's a lot of stoking this idea of external enemies here. But internally, there's also this other factor here, which is a presidential election scheduled here for March. Vladimir Putin is expected to run, and there's been some rumors, in fact, this week that he'll start to roll out essentially his presidential campaign. And I think that there's a sense that certainly it does create a nice video image for this Russia coming off its knees, as Vladimir Putin likes to say. There's just imagine all this video footage of tanks and troops and a strong Russian army. Now, it was said today that by Putin's spokesman that Putin may, in fact, visit these Zapad 2017 trainings to assess. And I imagine that cameras will be in tow as well.
NATO officials are really concerned by these war games. Are they right to be nervous?
Well, you know, you can understand why, for example, if you're in the Baltics or Poland, you might be nervous. Their histories are so intertwined with Russia's and under Russia's thumb. But I think it's really important to point out that we haven't seen any real propaganda campaign by Russia to sort of whip up hysteria towards the Baltics. So say, for example, if we look at what happened with Ukraine after the Maidan Revolution in 2014, that's when they overthrew a pro-Moscow government in Ukraine. And at the time, you saw state media here kind of make the case that Ukrainian fascists were out to ethnically cleanse the Russian-speaking population in Ukraine. You know, we haven't seen anything like that with the Baltics. Certainly, there's a point of contention in how the Baltics treat their Russian minorities, but there's not quite that level of hysteria here.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks very much, Charles.
Thanks, Marco.
Motel 6. You might recognize the name or the slogan.
I'm Tom Baudet for Motel 6, and we'll leave the light on for you.
Well, the folksy motel chain is suddenly facing some harsh criticism. That's because it's been reported that staff at two of its locations in Phoenix have been handing over guest information to federal immigration officials. One Twitter user's take on the story, Motel 6, they'll leave the light on and also call ICE. According to the Phoenix New Times, which broke the story, those calls to Immigration and Customs Enforcement have led to the arrests of several undocumented immigrants. Antonia Farzan co-reported this story. How many of these arrests, Antonia, were you able to pin down in your reporting?
We were able to pin down at least 20, and we know that there are likely more, since often the information that makes it into the court record is so vague. So we were reaching out to local attorneys for confirmation about what we were seeing. But there are still a couple of cases that we weren't able to nail down. So definitely know this is only the tip of the iceberg.
And we're talking basically two branches of Motel 6, right?
Yeah, all 20 happened just at these two locations between February and August, as far as we could tell.
Can you just give us one example of one of the stories you heard of an undocumented immigrant being arrested at one of these motels?
Sure. I mean, the story we start with is that of Manuel Rodriguez Juarez, who was a local landscaper. He got in a fight with his live-in girlfriend and went to stay at the Motel 6. They asked him for ID, and he gave them his Mexican electoral ID because that was all he had. Then around 11 p.m. that night, he's watching TV. There's a knock on the door, and it's two ICE agents. So that led his lawyer to suspect possibly that someone in the motel had noticed, you know, this guy checked in with a Mexican ID. He only speaks Spanish. Let's call ICE.
So in your reporting, you spoke with staff at the two Motel 6 locations where the arrest took place. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, that was really surprising, because what we'd been hearing from attorneys was there's all these rumors that, you know, maybe there's one person who was individually tipping off ICE, who maybe was getting paid to do so. And when, you know, I asked flat out, is that happening? We're told, oh, no, we give everyone's guest information to ICE. So it turned out that their policy was to send a full guest list after they did the night audit, which then presumably we weren't able to get confirmation from ICE on this. But my guess would be that ICE would be checking it against existing Homeland Security databases to find people who had been deported before.
Does that policy exist just at those two Motel 6s, or is that kind of national Motel 6 policy?
Well, we'd love to know the answer to that. They did respond to our story late last night and said that it was something that had been implemented at the local level without knowledge of senior management and was being discontinued. But we're definitely hoping other journalists will look into this in their communities and see if there's a pattern of arrests at Motel 6 as well, because their answer really didn't answer a lot of the questions we have in terms of, you know, if law enforcement shows up looking for a specific person, will Motel 6 let them do so without a warrant?
Right. So Motel 6, in that statement last night, they said this kind of practice would stop. But did they actually deny this was happening?
They didn't, which was interesting.
Legally, can Motel 6, can any motel or inn do this kind of thing?
Yeah. So there's a Supreme Court decision in 2015 that basically said a local municipality cannot require hotels or motels to hand over their guest list to police. However, if a hotel or motel wants to do so, that's up to them. So in this case, that seems to be what's happening. We don't have any evidence to suggest that ICE or local police were forcing them to turn that information over without a warrant. And if you look at the privacy policy on Motel 6's website, they do cover every single possibility, including the fact that your information, including a copy of your ID, might be shared with law enforcement at some point during your stay or even after your stay.
I don't know what you've been hearing from people, but does this mean for undocumented immigrants that kind of all hotels in the U.S. are now off limits for them? Are they that fearful?
I think it's definitely a question people should be asking, and anyone who cares about their privacy as well. You know, if you're checking in with an ID at a motel, are they going to share that with local police? Who else is going to get access to your information? So it's definitely a good question to be asking before you check in.
Antonia Farzan with the Phoenix New Times. Antonia, thanks for telling us about your reporting.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And now, time for a story about nothing. Zero is symbolically, for many people, not a great number. It's the absence of something. And for young people studying math, zero is challenging. because the concept of nothing is kind of hard to get your head around. And yet, a manuscript written on tree bark and found more than a century ago in what is now northern Pakistan has revealed a remarkable secret, the first recorded use of the mathematical concept of zero. Professor Marcus du Sartoy of Oxford University was the man who pushed for the manuscript to get carbon dated. And Professor, what does the manuscript actually show?
Well, it shows that the zero that we use today, which we knew came from India, is much earlier than we ever thought it was. There was a temple that I visited in Gwalior in India, which had a zero inscribed on the wall, and that dated to 876 AD. But then I discovered that my library at the University of Oxford had this manuscript with lots of mathematics written in Sanskrit on it, which had the zero that we use today, but nobody knew what the date of this manuscript was. So I thought it would be very exciting to know, and I tried to persuade the Bodleian Library to get it carbon dated. And we all got a shock because it's much earlier than anybody thought.
How old is it?
Well, it dates from some of it from the 3rd and 4th century AD. And the style of writing, people had dated it maybe 8th, 9th, 10th century. So to find it's 3rd, 4th century is really staggering. So zero that we use today, it's the seeds that gave birth to that zero, is much earlier than anyone thought.
So what exactly is this manuscript? What kind of text is it?
Yeah, it's very strange. It seems to be a set of examples trying to train up Buddhist merchants to do calculations. So it's a lot of those kind of puzzles you get at school where you're given a sort of challenge. Somebody sells a number of apples, buys them back at this price, sells them again. What was the original price? And it's there that we see this zero. It isn't a zero in its own right yet in this manuscript. And that's important perhaps to stress. It's zero as part of a number. So like 101 has a zero to denote no tens. But this is the zero which would give rise in the 7th century AD to the concept of a symbol for absolutely nothing, which, you know, was a really big leap to think of. Why do you need a number to count nothing? Numbers are counting things.
And did that 3rd century zero look like the zero we use today, basically a circle?
Well, it is actually a dot. And across the world, you find a dot. For example, if you're in Egypt, you will see the dot still being used to represent zero. So that dot evolves into the circle that we use today.
So take us back to school, if you would, Professor. Why is zero such an important concept? Because I imagine people have always been able to say that grain store over there, it's empty, or there are no livestock left to sell in the barn.
I think it's important to sort of remember perhaps how the Romans used to write their numbers, because the Romans didn't have a symbol for zero. So it meant that in order to get larger and larger numbers, you had to create new symbols for those. So C for 100, M for 1,000, and they're very unwieldy. So the zero enables us to write huge numbers with just 10 symbols, 0, 1, up to 9. But I think the exciting thing is the idea of zero in its own right. And, you know, in Europe, when this was first introduced in the 12th, 13th century, when it came across these trade routes through to Europe, people were very suspicious of it. They considered it a number of the devil. Why do you need a number for nothing? And I think it's really indicative of India was a culture that was quite happy with the concept of the void, of nothingness. It's part of their philosophy, their religion. And so I think they were not so scared of the idea of nothing in the same way that the Europeans were scared.
I don't know about England, but here in the U.S., people use zero as an insult. Like, to call someone a zero ain't exactly complimentary. I don't know. Zero is like the Pluto of integers. Do you think this discovery will help burnish zero's reputation?
I think so. And if you think about our modern age, actually, it's completely built on the idea of something and nothing, zeros and ones. The digital age celebrates zero, and we really couldn't even be talking across from Europe to America without the power of zero.
Professor Marcus du Sartoy of Oxford University, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World.
Let me tell you something. The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth, period.
A recognizable voice there. That's President Barack Obama speaking to Congress last year.
People of the world do not look to Beijing or Moscow to lead. They call us.
This talk about America's greatness is pretty standard fare for a U.S. president. It's usually directed toward a domestic audience, but it is heard around the world, and it can sound very different if you're somewhere else. Writer Susie Hansen grew accustomed to hearing it in the years she lived in Turkey, and she says it left her feeling awkward, kind of like a kid who doesn't want to admit to her parents that she knew there was no Santa Claus. She writes about that in her new book, Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World.
Someone was recounting a story of people in Turkey sort of expressing happiness when September 11th happened. And this look is not all that common. I mean, there are many, many other foreigners who told me the exact opposite. Obviously, we remember that in Iran, they were lighting candles. And, they, you know, there was a, right. an outpouring of... But the reason why it was interesting to me was that it was Turks who would have felt that way. And that was when I thought, well, wait a minute, what did we do to Turkey? I had no idea what they were talking about. And I think that the shattering thing about those kind of moments was that the foreigners and Greeks were like this, Egyptians were like this, Iranians were like this. They knew us. They knew this history. It was part of them. It was so deeply part of them. And it wasn't at all part of me.
There's also the example of how your father worried about you. There's this moment early in your trip, he sends you an email, timestamp 3 a.m., and it says, Susie, did you know that Turkey is 99% Muslim? Are you out of your mind? What was your answer to him? Well, what does that say about your mindset at the time?
September 11th made everybody so scared. My reaction to my father, whose politics, I would say, are extremely different from mine, was, well, you know, in Turkey, it's different. They restrain Islam on some level. They even restrict where women can wear a headscarf. There was some part of me that believed that the Islamic world or Islamic countries or the religion of Islam needed to be restrained was something that I later realized I really needed to examine and really needed to understand. I say in the book, we all kind of lost our minds a little bit. And I think it's very important to remember that we had this reaction of, what are we going to do? We have to fix something. We have to fix this. We have to intervene in some way. And that's because we believe in our own sort of goodness and our good intentions.
Yeah, over the course of the years you spent in Turkey and then traveling to Greece and Egypt, Afghanistan and Iran, you begin to see the world differently. You start processing this stuff and you begin to draw some conclusions about what it means to have grown up in an empire. What begins to crystallize for you?
One's foreign policy, especially if it is the most powerful country in the world, has something to do with who you are. It has something to do with your own confidence in the world. It has to do with the way that you see yourself. I mean, to a large degree, I think of a lot of the things that are happening right now in the U.S. with Trump and everything else has to do with white Americans, often white men, feeling very, very threatened by what they see as this decline in their own status, which is not just domestic. I do think that it's also international, and I think it's terrifying. And liberals also are, and the left, heartbroken to discover that American exceptionalism was a myth to a very large degree. And when I went abroad, I could not see it that way anymore because the majority of what I was hearing from foreigners was about violence and violence against them.
You know, this really hits home for me because my younger self took off from the States in the mid-80s. I went to West Africa with the Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. And the notion there was that America and Americans can do good in the world. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that in a post-9/11 world, that idea is just passé?
I don't think we can figure out what that good is, whatever the definition of that is, until we can reconsider this history and have a very, very serious conversation about it. And until individuals are made to feel as if it is part of them and part of who they are, who they have been. And I think that once they, I would hope, I mean, this is a little bit optimistic on my part, but I would hope that people would think, well, okay, maybe the way that I have interpreted my history and interpreted the idea of, you know, what it means to be American has been false on some level. And what would I actually like that identity to be?
So can you relate that to this last question? I mean, one of the reasons you went to Turkey is because one of your literary heroes, the great writer and activist James Baldwin, spent a decade living there in the 60s. What sort of conclusions does he lead you to personally and intellectually?
He was, as I explain in the book, the first person to explain to me what it meant to be a white American. I had never really thought about it. And again, I was very conscious of race relations. It was one of my main, you know, academic interests. But I mean, I had never thought of myself as white American. I had almost thought of myself as not having any identity at all. And I think what Baldwin does is he very much explains to you who you are. What happened when Baldwin went to Istanbul, and he lived there on and off, he never wrote about Turkey, but he did give interviews to Turkish journalists, and he said, wow, you know, something very dangerous is happening here. This was in the 60s, remember, mm-hmm. So it's right after World War II. And he said, the U.S. is starting to get so deeply involved in all of these countries. And of course, Turkey was one of the main ones because of the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan. And he said, you know, this is dangerous that a country that has not yet dealt with its own hatreds, its own racism, and its own dark and bloody history is now purporting to show the rest of the world or remake the rest of the world in its image. And I get the feeling from his words, it made him almost tremble with fear, you know, that this is really so dangerous. And I think that helped me to understand the relationship between whites and blacks in America and the relationship between Americans and people abroad. And that it was in many ways the same kind of power relationship, but one in which the white Americans were able to believe that they were innocent on some level. And I think that is also a very, very deep part of the American education system and American propaganda, which is to sort of keep telling us that, you know, we are innocent of our history and we're not.
I mean, I love James Baldwin. What does Baldwin tell you is the way forward?
There's two sides to his, I would say, different strains in his work. The one that I did single out in my book was love was his ultimate, not solution, but what he was kind of encouraging, that it's the only answer, is what he said at one point. And that is something that as a younger person, when I was 24 years old and reading it, or 23, I didn't understand what he meant. It just seemed like a very simplistic thing. But I think that after living abroad and seeing the direct suffering many foreigners went through because of my own country, I did feel in response a kind of love. And I think that you do when you go abroad, because you feel a different kind of empathy and a different kind of affection and a different kind of relationship with the rest of the world and with individuals. And it is a form of love. And I think that once you start to feel that and feel that different kind of empathy, you would conduct yourself very, very differently.
Susie Hansen's new book is Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World. Susie, great conversation. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's The World for today, coming at you with love from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.